You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Welcome to Before They Were Live, an ongoing, monthly, and extremely nerdy conversation through the land of fairy, or the perilous realm. In his seminal essay on fairy stories, J.R.R. Tolkien says he has hardly been more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder but not of information. We take the same tack. We are, as ever, interested in playing our part in a healthy ecosystem of art and criticism and fandom, paying attention to the way stories have shaped our collective imaginations. We are slurpers of soup, happy to ladle out a bowlful from the great cauldron of story that has been bubbling and brewing for centuries. W.H. Auden said, "Art is our chief means of breaking bread with the dead." So pull up a chair to our table, grab yourself a soup bowl, a big old chunk of homemade bread, help us enrich the reading experience, and have some fun, too. Today, this is our first episode of many. I don't know how many it'll be, but this is our first episode on the Arabian Nights, the 1001 Arabian Nights. We are reading from the Penguin Classics edition, a new translation by Malcolm C. Lyons. And we're talking about nights 0 through 19. And joining me, as always, I have no clever introduction today, Michael. I'm sorry, but it's Dr. Michael Farmer. Hey, Michael.
Thank you, Josh. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Let me tell you a story so you don't behead me or something.
Yeah, we should tell our listeners a story about what it's like to record with Microsoft Teams instead of Microsoft Skype, which is what we've been using for 10 years or however long we've been doing this show. They discontinued it, and now we're desperately trying to figure out how to use Teams instead.
Yeah.
It's not a very good story, but to be fair, it's not a good program either, so.
Here we are. Well, let's see. I picked the Arabian Nights, or we picked it together, but I kind of suggested them because we had rewatched Aladdin, and that was really about all I knew about them, you know? I think I had a vague understanding of our frame story, which we're going to talk about in just a minute, so I won't spoil anything there. But what's your experience coming to this, Michael?
I think I had tried to read the, is it Richard Burton or is that just Elizabeth Taylor's husband? I think they have the same name. It's the translation from like the 18th century into English. I think I had tried to read that a few years ago. And so I was aware of how complex and interlocking these stories are. It's not like Grimm's where you get one story and then another story and then another story. What you get is one story that includes two stories, and that second story includes three more stories, and then it overlaps into the fourth story. It's a ridiculously complex text, which makes it fun, but which also makes it difficult for us to kind of excise stories to talk about. So I'm sure as we talk about these, we're just going to say, and then they tell another story that we're not going to talk about because otherwise we would just have to go through every single one of them and we would be reading the Arabian Nights for the next 3 years instead of the next year.
Yeah. And I do. I really like the complexity of it. I think it is super fun. In fairness, listeners, if you're worried that you're going to be missing something by us glazing over some stories, I think sometimes the stories they tell, it's hard to see the direct connection to what's happening. So you won't be missing too much. Sometimes it's easier than others. It depends on the interior story. So,
right. And the history of this text is kind of like the history of Grimm's in the sense that nobody knows where these stories come from. You don't have just one person sitting down and making them all up. They're compiled over centuries and kind of stuffed together. I would be very interested in knowing the process by which they came to be compiled into this text, but I'm not sure anybody actually knows that process. So as mysterious as the Grimm's stories felt at times, this feels even more mysterious. And part of that, too, is that it's a culture we're less familiar with than medieval Europe.
Sure. And yeah, there was, I mean, I said so many times during our Grimm's episodes, like, I just feel like I'm missing something here. Like, there's some cultural background or something. And that was within our, you know, basically Northern European heritage background, you know, that both you and I share. And so, yeah, this one, there's definitely a lot that I know that I'm missing. But the stories are, you know, they're curious. And so it'll be fun to discuss them.
The other funny thing is that the two stories everybody knows from this, Aladdin and Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, I don't think either one of them is actually in the collection. Our edition here includes as a appendix Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, but I don't think it's actually in the canonical version of the 1001 Nights.
Yeah, they include it because people expect it, I guess. But
right. And I think actually the same is true of Aladdin. I think that must, you know, so this is this book that is almost too big to open is just volume one of three. So I think maybe they might include Aladdin in one of the later two volumes, which we won't do immediately, I don't think. I think by the time we get to the end of this doorstopper, we're probably going to want to break from the Arabian Nights.
Yeah, so we'll, as always, we'll see where things take us as we go.
The other thing I was not prepared for, and maybe you were and maybe you weren't, is that some of these stories are quite explicit. These are definitely not things you want to start reading to your kids before you vet them.
Yeah,
some of them are fine.
Yeah, but they're buried within stories that are not so fine.
Right.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of fornicating happening in these stories.
And described rather graphically, much more graphically than I would have expected from a medieval Islamic text.
Yeah, that was the shocking part to me. And I was like, so, I mean, I wouldn't want anyone to, you know, pick up Grimm's and feel like they had a real deep understanding of what Christianity taught or accepted or something like that, you know? I mean, as we went through Grimm's, we found a lot of parallels, and I'm sure we missed several parallels, but there was a lot where it's like, well, you know, like, I mean, I'm thinking of like the devil and his grandmother or something like that, where it's like, yeah, this isn't really the biblical version of the devil. This is something else, you know? And so as I was reading these, I had to keep reminding myself of that. I was like, well, this isn't really like, you know, who knows, you know, like what the level it is to...
We're not reading the Quran.
Yes, we're not reading the Quran, yes.
I've never read the Quran. I'm not any kind of scholar of Islam. I teach a little bit of medieval Islamic history in my 10th grade class. So I do know that the 1001 Nights are largely compiled after what's called the Abbasid Revolution, whereby I can't remember if he's called a caliph or not. He might be called a sultan. Al-Rashid kind of becomes in charge of the caliphate, and this is when the capital moves to Baghdad, and it's when the Islamic Golden Age happens, when you get that immense flowering of literature and poetry and philosophy and mathematics and science and all the rest of it that's taking place in Baghdad. So I think maybe a way to think about, and I don't know if this description is accurate or not, but the way I was thinking about it is that this is kind of akin to the Renaissance in Christian Europe, in the sense that it's very grounded in Christianity, but also you get this kind of new embrace of the body, and you get a lot of ribaldry. Stuff that goes on here reminds me of something you might see in like François Rabelais' Gargantua and Pantagruel, or something like that, where it's got a kind of Christian background to it, and yet you know, it's not Thomas Aquinas.
Sure.
And yeah, Al-Rashid, if I'm not mistaken, actually shows up in, like, he is the king in The Porter and the Three Ladies of Baghdad.
Oh, really? Yeah. See, everything you just said there was, you know, a lot of it just sounded a bit like gobbledygook, because I'm so blank on that whole era of history and everything. So, yeah, I would not have put those names together at all.
Well, my understanding is after the Abbasid Revolution, you get a kind of secularizing of Islam. But again, I have half a lecture on this that I give to 10th graders. So I hope nobody is mistaking me for an expert on medieval Islam, or indeed any kind of Islam.
Sure. Yeah. So all those disclaimers out of the way.
Fortunately, I mean, while it has a kind of Islamic background, I think the stories are pretty transferable. I mean, there's I imagine as we go through, we'll actually see some fairly strong parallels to stuff we've already read in Grimm's and stuff we know from other folklore and things like that, because, you know, we talked about this a lot when we talked about Grimm's. There's something about these folklore stories that get down to the very beginnings of humanity. And so I think that's true here of the Arabian Nights just as much as it is of Grimm's.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, there's actually some parallels I wanted to point out even today as we go through these. So,
well, why don't we get started by talking about the frame story? And this is the third thing that everybody knows about the 1001 Nights. They know Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, Open Sesame. They know Aladdin and the Lamp, and they probably know the story of Scheherazade. But the story, as I knew it, is really only part of it. So the story I was always told about Scheherazade is that there's this terrible Persian sultan, and every night he marries a virgin, and then he kills her after he has sex with her, and then he marries another one the next night. And Scheherazade, to put an end to this practice, decides to, after he marries her, to start telling him a story, and then cut it off right at the most exciting part, so that he'll keep her alive for another night and allow her to live so that he can hear the rest of the story the next night. And she does this for 1001 nights. And that is what happens. But it doesn't give you, like, that version of the story, you don't get the background as to why he's so murderous and misogynist. So here's what happens. There is a king, a Sasanian king, so that is a king of Persia. And there's actually two of them. There's an older and a younger, and the older is actually the better one than the younger. He's a better man. He's more just, and this is the one who's going to end up marrying Scheherazade. But first, his younger brother is going to come visit him, and before he leaves, after he leaves, he comes back to get something, and when he comes back, his wife is sleeping with a black slave, is the way the translation puts it. So she's cheating on him with a racially otherized slave, and he responds by killing both of them and then going on to his brother's palace as if nothing had happened. But he can't quite shake this feeling. He feels really disgusted by the whole thing. He doesn't tell his brother about it, but he's kind of horrified. And then he finds out that something even worse is going on at his brother's palace, which is that his wife is having like an orgy with a whole bunch of slaves while the brother doesn't know. And so so he tips the brother off, tells him what's happened to him, and then tells the brother what's happening in his own palace. And they kind of hide and watch it happening. And they're both like really, really furious. And so the older brother, whose name is Shahryar, he says, we need to find someone else that this sort of thing is happening to, or else we may as well just kill ourselves. There's nothing left to live for. So they go out on the road and they run into this woman and a genie. And it turns out that the woman is married to the genie. That he has, he's kind of kidnapped her and forced her to marry him. And she retaliates by, anytime the genie goes to sleep, she has sex with more men and keeps rings from them. And she actually forces Shahryar and the younger brother to sleep with them. And I guess this is just what pushes him over the edge. And he says that women aren't to be trusted. They're sexually insatiable. They aren't faithful. They will take advantage of any man they can. And that's what leads him to start marrying virgins, deflowering them, and then murdering them the next morning and marrying another. And Scheherazade, when she finds out about this, she volunteers to marry him because she has this plan. And her father tries to talk her out of it, and we get the first interior story, The Bull in the Ass, where he attempts to talk her out of it and to no avail. And then she marries him, and she tells him and her sister, whose name I can never remember. Let me look at it. Dunyazad? Yeah, Dunyazad, who is sleeping underneath the bed where the king and her sister are. She starts telling him the first story, and that's what the 1001 Nights are. It's a set of stories that stretch over 1001 nights. I don't know if it's more or less than 1001 stories, but we're looking at kind of... How many did we read for today, Josh? How many of the big stories? The level one stories.
Oh, I think... So we read 19 nights, and I think in the 19 nights there are three large overarching stories.
Right, and so level one stories is what I called them, and then each of those has a number of stories that are inside it, where she's telling a story, and then the characters in that story are telling another story that the king is also hearing, and again, just ridiculously complicated. But that is the premise of the book, that women are untrustworthy, and that this king is going to murder basically as many of them as he can in retaliation for the various acts of inconstancy and infidelity that he's seen in the women in the world. Did I leave out anything interesting there, Josh?
No, I think you covered it pretty well. So the other thing that I took away from it, though, was there's like this weird hierarchy that's kind of set up there, where the younger brother is distraught until he realizes the same sort of thing is happening to his older brother. And then the older brother is distraught until he realizes, well, this is also happening to this genie, who I guess in the hierarchy would be, I don't know exactly what to make of genies. They're definitely, they're not demigods exactly, but they're, I don't know what they are. They're more,
I think they're like on the level of angels and demons.
Yeah, that's what I would say. They're on like the level of angels and demons. So like they're in the cosmology hierarchy, I think they're above kings even, right? And so then once he sees this is even happening to the genie, then you're right. There's the disgust with all women, but there's also it's kind of like, oh well, in the hierarchy, like it's also happening at the level above me, so it's okay, I guess, you know?
Right. Well, it happens worse. It happens to a worse degree the further up the hierarchy you get.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
The younger brother's wife is sleeping with one slave. The older brother's wife is sleeping with a bunch of slaves. And then the genie's wife is just sleeping with every man she comes across.
Yeah. So, yeah. So anyway, I just feel like we'll come back to, like, we'll see some of these hierarchies again. And so it's worth pointing out here that there's something about it. I don't know exactly what, but there's something to it. And then the other thing I was going to say was about Shahrazad, that she kind of enters the picture when there are no, there's no other virgins left. So people have been fleeing the kingdom so that their daughters won't have to marry the king, or, you know, the ones who have stayed, their daughters have all been used up already, so to speak. That sounds terrible, but it is terrible. I don't know how else to put it. And so the reason that she's still in the city is because her dad is a vizier. And as you said, he doesn't want her to have to do this or to die, but she, I mean, I guess in some ways she outwits him in some ways. She at least, you know, the story that he threatens her with is that, you know, he's going to beat her until she submits, but he doesn't go through it. You know, her confidence or her something, you know, something about her, convinces him to let her try what, you know, her scheme, and then her scheme works, which is in a weird way, it kind of proves the point of the, you know, like women get what they want is kind of the king's like,
right,
thing.
And yeah. That women aren't to be trusted, but her not being to be trusted is much different than what the king expected. It's not that she's going out and sleeping with other men.
No. Yeah. It's just more that she's not going to be, taken advantage of in that way, I guess. So.
Yeah. It's really hard to overstate how horrible this is.
Yeah,
and it's really terrible. It's put forth in such a matter-of-fact way, which again is something we saw over and over again in the Grimms, just horrible things described in a total flatness of affect.
Yeah. So.
And what saves the day is story.
Right. And that's...
it's a matter of life and death.
Yeah. And that I think is the thing that makes it very appealing to a podcast like ours, where we're very interested in story and its effects and stuff. So I think it's really cool in that sense that, like, story is the thing that saves the day. But it is, man, it's horrifying. It's a horrifying world that these people live in. That's for sure. So what else? Anything else to say about the prologue, or should we jump into one of the first stories here?
Yeah, let's jump into one of the first stories, although we're skipping the entirety of the first level one story, The Traitor and the Djinn, which is one of the more famous ones, actually.
Yeah, probably because people can only get so far into this, I guess.
Before they completely lose track of where they are. And Josh and I made a chart that I'm looking at right now that's color-coded, and it tells you where all the stories are within the other stories, and it's the only way I could keep track of it.
Yeah. It's very helpful. I'm glad you made it for us. yeah, because I even see, you know, there's a chart in the end of the, in the back of the book, but the third chart is not color coded, and it's got like parentheses, and it's like, I can't follow the parentheses. I'm like, where am I at now? So yeah, it's your chart is much better. All right. Anyway, so this story is called The Vizier and the Sage Duban. I don't know. Duban is how I'm going to say it. In this story, which, speaking of starting with terrible stories, this one is pretty terrible, but interesting, I think. There's some interesting stuff in it. So once upon a time, there's a king, and this king has leprosy, and no one can cure his leprosy. And then into the kingdom comes this sage, Duban, and he meets the king, and he says, I've heard, O king, that, you know, no one can cure your leprosy, but I can do it, and you name the day and I'll do it. And the king says, well, you know, cure me tomorrow. And the sage says, no problem. So the sage goes home, and he creates a polo stick, like the field game with the horses, polo, creates a polo stick and ball, and he puts the medicine that's going to cure this leprosy into the polo stick. And he brings it to the king, and he says, King, you just need to work up a really good sweat. So your palm is really sweaty. So I want you to take this polo stick and this ball, and I just want you to hit it as hard as you can, and just, you know, keep going until you've really worked up a sweat. And so the king does this, and he, you know, chases the ball around the field, I guess, with his horse, and works up a real good sweat. And when the sage has seen that the king has really worked himself hard, he says, okay, go take a bath and I'll see you tomorrow. And so the king goes and he takes a bath, and then he comes out of the bath, and he's completely clean and cured of his skin disease. I think it says he's as silver as the moon or something like that. And so the next day, the sage comes back, and the king is, of course, incredibly pleased, and he starts rewarding him with all these gifts and robes of honor and feasts and all these things. And there is a vizier who becomes very jealous of Duban and all the honors that he is receiving. And so he convinces the king that Duban is actually a spy that has been sent into the kingdom in order to kill the king. And he starts the king's mind working on how Duban could be actually traitorous. And the king is suspicious, but he's also, at first, he's like, this guy healed me, and, you know, he doesn't want to believe that he could ever hurt him, but the vizier very cunningly kind of brings up the point that, well, if he can, you know, if no one else could cure you and only he could, then maybe no one else could kill you, but only he could. And very funnily to me, I think, at least, the king gets this idea in his head. He's like, oh yeah, if he could kill me by me touching something, or if he could heal me by me touching something, then he could kill me with a smell. And so he just like repeats that several times, like, he could kill me with a smell, which comes out of, you know, his own mind. But there it is. And so he becomes extremely suspicious of Dubon, and he calls him in let him know that he's going to execute him. And of course, Dubon, cries for mercy, and he says, you know, your job as the king is to establish justice, and you should be merciful. And if mercy is done to me, then God will show mercy to you. But the king is not having any of it. So Dubon realizes that he's going to die. And so he asks if he can at least have one day to put all of his affairs in order. And he says, if you do this for me, then I will give you one of my magical books. And in fact, I'll give you a powder also. And so when you behead me, you can put this powder on a plate, and you can put my head on the plate, and the powder will stop the blood from flowing, and I'll be able to talk to you and answer your questions. And the king is delighted by this prospect. And so he's like, really? That's great. And so he sends Dubon away. Dubon prepares the powder, and he prepares this book to bring to the king. So he comes back the next day. He's beheaded. They put the head on the tray, and the blood stops flowing, and Dubon speaks to the king, and he says, go ahead and open and read the first three pages of this book. And the pages are stuck together, and the king is like trying to get them apart, and he licks his fingers to try and get them apart. And he doesn't realize that this book has been poisoned. And as he's trying to get these pages apart, he's keeps licking his fingers, and he's getting the poison, he's ingesting the poison, and then by the time he does realize it, of course, it's too late, and he dies. And Dubon gives a final word of you should have listened to me. God would have allowed you to live if you'd allowed me to live, but because you didn't allow me to live, God has rightly killed you, and you're a tyrant, and tyrants never win. And that's the end of the story as of the vizier and the sage Dubon. So I feel like I always lose a little traction at the end of the story. So I don't feel like,
to be fair, a lot of these stories kind of lose traction.
Yeah. Landing the ending is hard. But, that's the story. He recites a poem and that's the end of the story. There's a lot of poetry in this book, which is fun.
Oh, yeah. People, anytime they're faced with a situation, they recite a poem.
Yeah, it's really amazing. I don't know how much of it they're supposed to be making up on the spot. And then sometimes it's like, as the poet has said, and I don't know if that means they're actually quoting a poet or if they're just calling themselves a poet in that moment and they're breaking into poetry, but it's really impressive. So.
Yeah, and sometimes the poetry is directly relevant to what's going on, and sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
But they seem to relate to their world mostly through narrative and through poetry.
Yeah,
it's kind narrative of a... is how they justify themselves, and poetry is how they like cope with the situation.
Sure. Yeah. So in some ways, it's really a beautiful culture in that way. But there's just so much horrific things happening all the time that it's hard to separate the two.
A lot of very unjust rulers.
Yeah. Although I guess we live in horrific times sometimes, and we're not breaking into poetry or telling very good stories. So maybe, maybe we're missing out. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I just wonder about the king listening to Scheherazade tell this story. Does it occur to him that he's something like this other king who's behaving unjustly towards someone who hasn't done anything wrong?
Yeah, there's definitely stories in here that seem aimed at the overarching story, but then like you said in our prologue, there's so many people, the way this book has been put together, there's so many stories that have been stuffed in that it's hard to know, maybe in the very original tellings there was more morals for the king, but now it seems like sometimes it seems like a moral for the king and sometimes it doesn't. So,
well, and we don't get any kind of response from the king if I'm remembering correctly. Basically, it's just always at the beginning of the next night, he's always just asking what happens. Like he wants the story, but he doesn't see any kind of moral force behind it.
Sure. I mean, I don't know what happens at the end of the 1001 night. Well, I do, like, he marries her, right? Like,
well, they're already married.
Well, I mean, like, he takes her as queen. Like, he's no longer threatening to kill her every night. Is that right?
I would assume.
Yeah, I think that's... I don't know. I haven't read to the end. But I think that's what happens. So maybe he finally says something in the end. But you're right. Like, in these stories, she always says, if the king will allow, or if the king permits me, and then he says no more than go on. Like, that's really, like, right. His only line. Go on, go on, go on, you know? So...
It's fascinating. She obviously has so much in common with the sage Duban in the sense that you're faced with this person who has all the political power in the world, and yet the real power belongs to this wise person. And Scheherazade is incredibly learned, right? She knows all these stories. She can recite them all from memory. She recites them in such a beautiful way. All the poetry that these characters have memorized, she has memorized, and just kind of puts it into place exactly where it belongs. And likewise, Duban, it says, knows everything there is to know about everything, right? Mm-hmm. There's this sense in which their power is actually much more important and much realer than the king's power. And the last poem in the Vizier in the Sage Duban says, they wielded power with arrogance, but soon it was as though their power had never been. If they had acted justly, they would have met with justice, but they were tyrants, and time played the tyrant in return, afflicting them with grievous trials. It was as though here fate was telling them there was a return for that, and time cannot be blamed. So like the entire book is showing us what real power is, and it's not the power to kill somebody, it's the power to keep somebody from killing you, either because you're a scientific genius, or because you know every story there is to know.
Yeah. And even beyond that, like, the power, like the kings in the story, like they're dead, you know? And even, you know, at some point everybody dies, but the stories themselves live on. Like we're still talking about them, you know? And so there's kind of that meta layer too of like the stories are going to outlive these people. Much more than even their wicked deeds will. So.
Did you notice, well, there's two stories within the Vizier and the Sage Duban, right? There's King Sinbad and his falcon and the prince and the gula, but there's almost a third one that as the king is about to put him to death, he says, oh...
It's something about the crocodile.
Yeah, it's something about the crocodile. He said to the king, if this is how you reward me, it is the crocodile's reward. The king asked for the story of the crocodile, but Duban replied, I cannot tell it to you while I am in this state. Which means, I guess, we're never going to hear the story of the crocodile's reward. Which is too bad, because it's a great title.
It is a great title. But yeah, you're right. And going back to what you just said, like the power to have somebody not kill you by telling a story, like that at that moment, it fails Duban, right? And so there is a sense of justice in the sense that, you know, Duban's death leads to the king's death. But there's a sweeter, more redemptive story, I guess, in which they both live, or, you know, Duban lives and the king, reforms or something. So,
I think in the Middle Ages, whether it's in the Islamic world or in the Christian world, justice tends to be seen as something that is done in reciprocity rather than something that is done positively. Does that make mm-hmm. sense? Like, to behave just is to punish people who have behaved unjust. It's not to do the right thing the first time. And you get, like, justice is done in this story, but it doesn't bring Duban back to life. And yet his is the final victory. We cheer, right? When the king accidentally poisons himself, the king is so suspicious of everything Duban does, but he's such a chump that he's not suspicious of this incredibly suspicious thing. That what, you're going to put this guy to death for no reason and he's going to be nice and give you something?
Right.
And you're not going to be suspicious of that?
Yeah.
But then the other part of it. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just saying he's too excited about getting the, you know, whatever it is that's promised there, you know, having the knowledge or having the secrets of that are supposed to be hidden in this book, I guess.
Yeah. Although part of it is that he's so soft-minded that he's tricked by his vizier, right? The reason he doesn't trust the Sage Duban is because the vizier is jealous of everything that Duban has gotten, and so he's the one who kind of slips this bug into the king's ear.
Yeah.
It says he's so envious that he grew to love his envy. It was a great description.
Yeah, it's a good one. I didn't write it down, but I remember what you're talking about.
So envious that he was in love with envy. It reminded me, I just finished teaching the Confessions for the 45th time or whatever, and there's a part in the Confessions where Augustine steals pears, and he says the reason he did it is he loved his sin. Hmm. That all our actions are motivated by love, and in that case, it's love of the sin itself. And like, that's how far gone the vizier is, that envy is for its own sake. At a certain point, it's not even about getting what the other person has. It's you enjoy the envy. You enjoy that bad feeling that comes. Does anything happen to the vizier? I don't remember that.
No,
I don't think it
nothing,
said anything about him.
That's it. That's the nothing. Nothing happens. So that's
because what you're expecting is something like the Book of Esther, right? The Book of Esther has a very similar format to this.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point.
So you're expecting Haman to be hanged, but that doesn't happen.
No, not in this telling. So, but maybe partly because, as we mentioned, this is one of the interior stories. So this story is being told to make a point, you know,
right? And then there's stories that make points within that story.
Right. Yeah. So maybe that's part of why, like, having the vizier hanged or whatever is kind of beside the point. At this point, the point of the story is, don't do wrong to those you have power over, or bad things will also happen to you. You know, that's the message that needs to be declared to, by the fisherman, which we're not talking about. So we won't get too deep into that, but that's what the fisherman is trying to express.
Well, shall we move on to the next one?
Yeah, I just want to, just real quick, I just wanted to mention that there's like a really weird relationship between fate and God that we're going to see over and over. So I don't need to, we don't need to prolong it here. But on the one hand, in this story, the idea is that if the king had agreed to save Duban, God would have saved him. But then on the other hand, when Duban first comes in to be executed, it says, quote, "He came gladly, not knowing what God the Merciful had ordained. What is decreed by fate will come about." So it's like almost like there's no way that it could have happened differently, even though the whole point of the story is if you'd acted differently, then it would have been different, you know? So I don't know. There's a weird tension there, and we'll continue to see it. So we don't need to belabor the point here, but I thought it was worth pointing out.
Right, right. And I mean, it's just the tension you run into anytime you talk about divine foreknowledge. You know what I mean? It's not like anybody else has satisfactorily answered the question.
Right. And you're right. There is that kind of general way, but it's just interesting in this story, in the book in particular, that we're reading, the way the translation is or the way the original is, I don't know. They seem to hold that tension very loosely. Like, they're not worried about it. It's like God can do it, but fate has ordained it. But, you know, and it's just, is God bound by fate or what? You know, like it's just not clear, and they're not concerned with it. But it's just an interesting tension that we'll continue to see.
All right. Well, we're skipping way ahead. We're leaving the fisherman and the djinn again, which we didn't talk about at all. We've moved on to the third level one story from the first 19 nights, which is the porter and the three ladies of Baghdad. And we are inside another story inside the porter and the three ladies of Baghdad. We're going to talk about the envied and the envier, which is, I think, the shortest. No, the third sheikh story from earlier is shorter, but this is one of the shorter ones. So there are these two neighbors. They live in a house that shares a wall, and one of them, for reasons that isn't given to us, envies the other one, and he does everything he can to undermine the other guy, and like his envy is just eating him up from the inside. Like he can't enjoy his life. He can't even sleep anymore because he's so envious of his neighbor. But meanwhile, his neighbor just gets wealthier and wealthier and more successful and more successful. And eventually the neighbor, the successful one, finds out that the other guy envies him, and he feels bad for the guy. And so he moves away from town and actually decides to live a kind of ascetic lifestyle to avoid the other guy envying him, which is really kind of an unbelievable unbelievable act of charity. I think you'll agree. But he dedicates himself to these pious acts and to voluntary poverty. And he becomes famous for his asceticism. And eventually his envious neighbor finds out how famous he is and how many people are going to ask him for advice. And so he decides to go visit him as well. And the envied guy welcomes him very warmly. But the envier ends up pushing him down a well to kill him, thinking that this is going to solve his problem once and for all. But fortunately for the envied, the well is full of genies. Jinn, I think, is the plural of genie. I don't know. There's genies in there, and they rescue him, and they feel bad for the guy who's envied because they understand that he hasn't done anything wrong, and also they recognize how pious he is, that he's a good man. And they talk about how even the king of this locale has found out about him and that he is going to go ask him for advice about what to do about this demon that's possessing his daughter. And the genies know what they need to do to treat the genie, or to get rid of the demon, to exorcise the demon. It turns out there's a black cat in the mosque with a white spot, and if they fumigate the girl with 7 of the white hairs from this cat, the evil spirit will go away. And so when the guy gets out of the well, that's exactly what he does, and in true fairy tale fashion, he is given the king's daughter as a wife in reward. And after the vizier dies, the envied man is made the vizier. And then after the king dies, he's made the next king. And then the envier, his old neighbor, happens to be walking by, and the king sees him, the formerly envied man sees him and orders him brought to him. But instead of murdering him, which is what almost any sane person would do, I think, the king gives him a whole bunch of gold from his treasury and sends him with a guard back to his hometown, where presumably he too is going to live in prosperity. And that's the story of the envied and the envier.
Yeah, I like that you said true fairy tale fashion, because this is the one that felt, of the stories that we read, this one seemed the most like a fairy tale to me. Like, it's a happy ending, and there's a lot of, like, there's so much grace in this story. I was yeah, kind of shocked by the amount of grace in the story, and forgiveness, and I wrote down the that line that you mentioned there, that, you know, by God, I shall abandon worldly things for his sake, is what the envied says. Like, he's like, I'll give up everything for this other guy so he can stop envying me. Like, really an act of extreme charity there. So, yeah, really interesting.
And then that's what I loved about this story, is just how gracious it is. And it doesn't go where you're expecting it to go. But it also has that kind of Joseph and his brothers quality.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And it's got a little bit of like an inverse of the, or not, inverse isn't the right word, but, you know, Jesus says, you know, to forgive those who sinned against you, and, you know, so that your Father will forgive you, or I'm botching it here, but you know what I'm saying?
I do.
Yeah. So in this one, the line is, who hopes that his superior will pardon him has to forgive inferiors their faults. And, you know, it's the same kind of idea of like, forgive those. It's like the parable that Jesus tells of the servant, you know, who owes a huge debt and the master forgives him, but then he runs off and demands a very small debt from one of his fellow servants. And so then when the master finds out about that, he throws him in prison. But in this story, you know, you actually see the smaller debt being forgiven, you know, if you want to put it that way. So.
Right. Although, to be fair, we don't see the envied actually owe anything to anybody.
No. Like, yeah, you're right.
He's presented as totally morally upright the entire time.
Yeah, he is. I just meant like overall, like we all owe our lives to God, but you're right that there's
right.
There's that sense that, yeah, he's just a completely righteous person and he acts so, you know, like, it's a neat story. It felt surprisingly Christian to me, you know, because I associate Christianity with grace and forgiveness and those sorts of things. So,
it's worth pointing out Muslims accept the New Testament, so that that parable would be familiar, I would think, to many original readers of this.
Yeah,
of this collection.
Sure.
They accept the New Testament in a certain way. I, again, not an expert on this.
Yeah, no, I'm not an expert either. And yeah, we don't need to hop down that rabbit trail because neither of us know enough to speak intelligently about it. All right. Well, are we ready to move on?
Yeah, let's do it.
That's such a good story. I feel like we should spend more time on it, but I don't have anything else to say about it really, except that I really like that one. So,
it is very short and to the point.
Yeah. All right. Now we get, this is called the third dervish's story. What has happened in the background is that there's three dervishes and they're all telling their stories. So this is the third one. You missed the other ones.
And a dervish is like a Islamic mystic, if I'm remembering correctly.
That's my understanding. Yeah. Is that, yeah, they're, and this one happens to be a king and a son of a king. And he starts his story by saying that the other two dervishes were victims of fate, but that he brought this fate upon himself, which I find very interesting once we get into the story. So that's how he starts it, is I brought this fate upon myself. So he was a king. He had a huge navy, and he loved to go out and travel the seas. And so he gets on a boat and he's going to go on a month long journey. And he has all the provisions and things with him, and they go out and they get blown off course. And so as they're off course for a number of days, they don't know where they are. And eventually they send the lookout up into the tower, and he sees something off in the distance, and he comes down and he tells the captain about it. And the captain says, "Good news. We're all dead. There's no surviving this. We've come upon the magnetic island." And the magnetic island is this giant magnet out in the ocean, and it's going to draw our ship to it. And then it's going to pull our ship apart. Like all the nails, anything metal on our ship is going to soar into that island. And it's going to literally rip our ship into pieces. And, there is a man on there's a dome, a brass dome on this island, and there's a brass man on top of the dome, and he's sitting on a horse, and he kills anyone who comes onto the island. And so even if we survive our shipwreck, then this guy's gonna kill us. And so sure enough, that's what happens. The ship gets torn apart. Most of the people drown, but our dervish, our king at this point, he survives. He washes ashore. He finds a path, and he goes up and he hides in the dome, and he goes to sleep, and he hears a voice that tells him that when he wakes up, he should dig underneath where he's standing. He'll find a bow and some arrows with lead arrows, and he can shoot the horse and the rider into the sea. And after he does that, he needs to rebury the bow, and then he needs to wait, and the oceans will rise, and a boat will come to him with another brass man, not the same brass man, and he needs to get on the boat with this brass man who comes to him on a boat, and this brass man will row him for 10 days back to land. But he is not allowed to mention the name of God during this entire time. So he wakes up, does all the things, shoots the rider into the sea, waits for the brass man to come, gets in the boat, rides for 10 days. On the 10th day, he sees land and he's so excited. He says, "Praise be to God." And so the boat tips over and nearly drowns again, but he can swim. And so he has to swim for an entire day, and he washes up onto land, and he's thankful. But it's just one bad thing after another with this guy, because now he's on this land and he doesn't know where he is, and he walks all around it, and he realizes it's a deserted island, and he's stuck now on this completely deserted island. Well, as soon as he realizes he's on a deserted island, he sees a ship coming, and because he doesn't know where he is or who these people might be, he hides himself in a tree. And off of the ship comes several slaves, and they dig a hole in the ground, revealing a trap door, and they open the trap door, and they bring all sorts of provisions, tons of provisions, off of the ship down into this hole in the ground, this vault in the ground. And then off of the ship comes a extremely old man and a beautiful young boy, and he is so beautiful that even beauty bows his head and says he's never seen anything as beautiful as this boy. And they take the boy down into the vault, and the old man and everybody else comes out, and they sail away. And so our king comes down out of the tree, and he digs up the trapdoor again, and he goes down the trapdoor to find out what's happening. He's like, what's going on here? And so he goes down, and he goes, and he talks to this boy, and this boy says, "My father was a great merchant, and he had all this wealth, but he had no children. And he had a dream that he would have a child, but the child would not live long. And the next day my mom became pregnant, and then I was born. And when I was born, he brought all these astrologers and to come and tell my fate. And they said I was going to live 15 years. And then in my 15th year, the bronze horse, or the brass horse and man, was going to be shot into the sea. And 50 days after he was shot into the sea, I was going to die. But if I could survive those 50 days, then I would live a long life." And so, and he even knows the name of the guy who's going to kill him. And it is the name of our king who's telling the story. And so, the astrologers told him all this. And, so he says, "That's why I'm hidden down in this hole." And the king thinks to himself, "I would never kill this child. I'm the one who shot the horse off the horse and the rider, but I would never kill this boy." And he says, "Let me stay here with you and keep you company for this time. And, we will, I'll protect you and watch over you." So, they're going to be there for 40 days. He shot the rider 10 days ago. As you may remember, there's a 10-day journey there. So, he's got 40 days to live. So he's on the 39th day, or the 40th day, he's going to serve this young youth a melon, and he asks the youth where the knife is, and the youth says, "Oh, it's on the shelf above me." And he says, "Oh, let me get it for you." And he reaches up and he gets the knife, and he trips and tragically falls onto the boy, killing him instantly with the knife. And he regrets it, and he says, "Oh, I was gonna, why did I ever want to give him this melon? And it's terrible." And so he quickly gets out of the vault, and he hides it all, and he hides in a tree again. And sure enough, the old man comes back with the servants, and tragically they dig up the vault, and they go down there, and they find the boy dead. And the old man is so sorrowful that he also dies. And so then our king is left there alone, doesn't know what to do. But sure enough, as soon as He's waiting for a little while. The seas start to recede. You'll remember earlier in the story that they all rose up when he shot the horse into the sea. So everything's receding. And it recedes enough that his island is no longer an island. So he begins walking, and he walks, and he comes upon this palace. And inside this palace are 10 one-eyed men. And he's very curious, but they say, don't ask us any questions about our why we only have one eye. We can't tell you, and it'd be very bad for you if we told you. And then each day they go through this mourning ceremony where they have ash and grease from dirty pots and stuff, and they slap their faces, and they say, we had everything, and our curiosity killed us, basically, or our curiosity destroyed us. And so this goes on for long enough that he can't stand it. He has to know. And they say, okay, if you have to know, then wrap yourself up in this animal skin, and this bird is going to come, and take you to the top of this tall tower, and then you can come out of the animal skin, and you'll find out our story, but we can't tell it to you. And so he does it. Very foolishly, I would say, but he doesn't. And so this bird comes and carries him to the tower. He comes down from the tower, and he basically enters this paradise type land. There's 40 women there, and they say, you'll be our king, and we'll be your slaves. And he's sleeping with them every night, a different woman every night, and it's endless pleasure, and it's all wonderful for him. And he does this for a year, and he forgets all the cares that he's ever had. And at the end of the year, they say, we have to go away for 40 days, and then we'll be back. But we won't see you, because you'll never survive for the 40 days. And so they're all mourning him. And he says, no, I'll be here. And they say, no, there's 40 doors in this palace, and you are only allowed to look into the 39th one. And if you look into the 40th one, then you'll never be allowed to return here. And he says, well, I surely won't look in the 40th room. But then they leave, and he looks in one room a day, and then, of course, each room is more wonderful than the last. And so on the 40th day, he can't stand it, and he has to look inside that 40th room, and he looks inside there, and there's a horse, and he jumps up on the horse, and he tries to get the horse to go by speaking to it, and it won't, and he tries by kicking it, and it won't. And then he takes a whip and he hits the horse. And when he does that, the horse grows wings and flies him up to another tall tower. And as the horse bucks him off, and as he gets bucked off, he hits him with the wing, knocking his eye out. So now he is also a one-eyed man. And he goes down out of the tower, and lo and behold, he's back with the 10 one-eyed men again. And he says, now I understand, let me stay with you. But even they won't have him, and they kick him out. And so he has to leave and wander, and he tears out his beard, and he mourns, and he does the same mourning ritual that they did. Like, I had everything, and my curiosity would not let me keep it. And that's the end of his story. It was a very long one, with many parts.
Yeah. Although not interrupted by a story of its own.
Yeah, but you keep thinking it's at the end, and then it's not at the end. But very interesting story. There's definitely some parallels there to other stories we've read in the past.
The Bluebeard story, which I can't remember if we talked. I know we didn't talk about it as Bluebeard, but we talked. I think we might have talked about it as in some other form, where the person's in the cottage and they're told they can look in any of the rooms, but not in the one room. And the guy's mm-hmm. been married 50 times. That's Bluebeard. You definitely have that.
Yeah. I feel like there was a couple Grimm's stories like that, where there's a series of rooms, and you can't look in the one particular room, or everything will go bad for you. So, we had several different versions of that story. So that was interesting to see it repeated here. And then, just again, the fadedness of things, it's kind of a, not exactly Sleeping Beauty, but a Sleeping Beauty-ish type story, where you know from the beginning that the youth is going to die, and, do everything you can to prevent it. And in the preventing, also, in a way, create, if the boy had just stayed home, you don't know what would happen, but the fact that he's on this island, and he ends up on the island with this other guy,
that's what was fated. It's kind of like Oedipus, where he gets the the oracle that he's going to kill his father and marry his mother, so they send him away, and then it turns out his father isn't really his father, and he's just, it's going to happen no matter how much you try to, no matter how much you can try to avoid it.
Yeah, but it's like the attempt to avoid it creates the situation where the thing happens, you know, is the tragic part. Like if instead of burying him in the ground for 40 days, he just stayed in his own kingdom, would they have ever, I mean, the idea, I guess, is that they would have met some other way, you know, like it would have happened some other way, but it's just, yeah, there's that tension with fate again, I guess.
Although it does, the horoscope he got does say your son will live for 15 years, after which he will be faced by a danger, but if he escapes, his life will be a long one. So it seems like you have a kind of forking path there for fate, that it's not guaranteed that he's going to die. What I don't understand is why the third dervish didn't go and stay somewhere else. Why did he stay with the boy, knowing that the boy was, you know, heavily suggested to die?
Right.
But I guess that's part of the fate.
Well, they're on a deserted island, and the boy has all the provisions. So I mean, you're right.
Yeah,
he could have, you know, like our envied in the other story, sacrificed himself, you know, in order to save this child, and said, well, you know, I'll fend for myself up here, and I'll never come down into the hole with you, you know. But but then again, you could also say, well, why not do everything possible, like eat the key if you have to, like what are you doing, like looking in the 40th room when you know you can't look in there, you know? So I guess in that way, I understand why he begins his story with, like, I've brought this all upon myself. But in another way, it's so many things have to happen for him to end up in the situations he ends up in that are outside of his control, that it's always his decision, you know, it's his decision to go sailing. It's his decision to stay in the vault with the boy. It's his decision to look in the 40th room, but also it's like, how could he have avoided any of these situations, you know?
So, all right. One of the times he's in trouble, it's because he's too pious. I thought that was interesting that he has to go 10 days without using the name of God, and he couldn't help himself but to say the Muslim confession of faith, there is no God but God.
Right. Oh, that was the other one that like reminded me of Bearskin, because in Bearskin he has to go 3 years without mentioning the name of God or whatever.
That's right, but without saying the Lord's Prayer, I think it is.
Yeah, or something like that. So
yeah, this one did feel very grim, both because of like actual elements in it and because it just kept going.
Right, that Shaggy Dog style that you always tend to bring up. So it's just that you think you're at the end of the story, and then it's a whole nother story begins.
But I think it actually holds together better than a lot of those Grimm stories.
Yeah, there's a sense of there is a narrative sense in it. You know, it doesn't just drop random characters and stuff. It's just the story of this one guy's adventure, and there's different parts to his adventure. You know, like he gets stranded on one island, and then he gets stranded on another island, and then, you know, he goes to this castle, and yeah. So there's a thread through it for sure.
I also really like the image of the magnetic island that just sucks the nails out of all the ships.
Yeah, me too. I got a real like, I love any sort of, you know, I guess it's like that, the travel story where you're coming across these different things, but I especially love boat ones where it's like random island, like Voyage of Dawn Treader is obviously in my mind here, but there's, you know, Gulliver's Travels, like any sort of story where you're like sailing to these different weird bizarre lands, you know? And so yeah,
Star Trek.
Yeah. so that magnetic island, I was like, wow, that's so cool. Like what a fun image, you know, just like this idea of like a whole island made out of a magnet. Really like it. And the captain, this story is actually, it's funnier than the way I told it, I think. Like when the captain's like, good news, we're all dead. You know,
it reminded me of Futurama, where Professor Farnsworth always says good news, everyone, when it's terrible news.
Yeah. So I really liked the there's a couple poems in this one I really liked. two little excerpts that I'll read here. So when he sees the son has died, the child has died, and the old man weeping over him, he says, this is a very surprising poem that the dervish says. He says, how many hidden acts of grace does God perform, whose secrets are too subtle to be grasped by clever man? How often in the morning trouble comes, while in the evening follows joy? And how many times does hardship turn to ease as pleasure follows the sad heart's distress? I really like that little poem. Like it comes at a weird time because it's in some ways it's looking for the hope in the story too soon. You know, like you're in the midst of the tragedy still. But I do like that idea that sometimes when bad things happen, there's actually a grace of God in it. So.
Right. And I mean, it's worth pointing out this guy becomes a dervish. He becomes a Islamic mystic.
Yeah. So after some more trials.
Well, we've got just one more.
Oh yeah. One more. Another sea adventure. Another sea adventure. So this is the eldest lady's story. Although I don't think she's the oldest. I think she's actually the youngest, but I think it's called the Eldest Lady Story. But anyway, it doesn't matter. So this lady, she has two dogs, two female dogs. And she says, these female dogs are actually my sisters. And my sisters got married and they left. First our parents died and they left us these equal amounts of wealth. You know, we divided it three ways. And so I took my wealth and I invested it and I did well. And meanwhile, my two sisters, they got married and their husbands were scoundrels and wasted all their wealth. And so one by one, they came back to me in rags and weeping. And I took them back and I treated them well. And I did all I could for them. After about another year, they wanted to get married again. And I said, I don't think it's a great idea. You've already experienced marriage. There's nothing more in it for you. But they both wanted to get married again. And so they got married again. And same similar type situation happened where they were, you know, the sister paid for the weddings and everything because they'd already lost all of their inheritance. And then the men squandered it and used them and then left them. And so they came back again. And this time, they're all back together and everything seems good. Everything is fine. She forgives them again. She's treating them well. Her wealth is continuing to grow. And she decides to go on this venture. She's a merchant. And so she's going to take all these goods on a boat with her and go sailing to sell her goods in another location. And she asks her sisters, do you want to come with me or do you want to stay here? And they say, oh no, we've already parted from you twice and we can't stand it. We always get ourselves into trouble. So we'll stay with you. And so they go together on this voyage. And of course, it's a voyage. So they get blown off course and they end up in a sea that the captain has never seen before. They don't know where they are. And they spot land and they go and they come upon this kingdom. And the kingdom, everyone in the kingdom has been turned to stone. Nothing else is stone. All the goods are there and beautiful and the silks on the walls and the silks that people are wearing, everything is lovely, but all the actual people have been turned to stone. And so they're very, curious and, you know, wondrous about this. And so they go into the city to explore. And our eldest lady, she heads towards the castle. And she gets to the castle, and it's this beautiful castle, and the king is surrounded by, you know, all these servants and slaves, and they're all dressed, you know, splendidly. It's just, I mean, it's amazing, the wealth and the beauty of this place. And she just cannot understand how they all turn to stone, and she goes into the harem and finds the lead queen sleeping there, and she's completely beautiful, but she's a stone. And she just continues to be amazed. And then she sees, she finds a chamber and she goes into this chamber and there's candles burning there. And she says, somebody must have still be around here to have lit these candles, because otherwise these candles would not, you know, still be burning when everybody's turned to stone. So she suspects that someone is around, and she goes and she's continuing to explore, but she cannot find anyone anywhere. So she goes back to, she gets lost. She can't find her way back to her ship. So she ends up back in this chamber with the candles burning, and she's going to rest there. And as she's resting, she hears somebody reading the Quran, and a very beautiful voice is reading the Quran. And so she follows the sound of the voice, and it is being read by a very, incredibly handsome. Again, he's as, you know, as beautiful as the moon and the sun and all these things. Like there's poetry about him. This incredibly handsome, beautiful lad is reading the Quran. And so she says, "How did you come to survive in this kingdom, in this beautiful kingdom where everything else has turned to stone?" And he says, "I'll tell you the story." And he tells the story that he was raised by a very pious Muslim woman, but all the people in the entire kingdom were, I forget what they're called, Magians, I think, fire worshipers, basically. And so they all worshipped fire. And only he was learned the way of Islam. His father did not know or suspect that this lady that was taking care of him, this nursemaid, was not also a fire worshiper. And so she taught him how to confess and how to do all the rituals of Islam. And then one day she died. And soon after that, there was a voice like out of heaven calling this city to repentance and to worship the true God and to give up their ways of worshiping fire. And the king said, "Oh, you don't have to listen to that. You can ignore that." And so the people went on in their wicked ways for another year. And then a year later, the voice came again. And then in the third year, the voice came again. And then the third time when they refused to repent is when this tragedy overtook them. And he survived because he was practicing Islam. And so that's why he survived. But he said, "I've been here alone and I can't stand it." And she says, "Well, come and marry me. I'm a wealthy merchantess and my ship is here and it's full of goods. And, you're beautiful and I've fallen in love with you and your story. And let's go be married." And so he agrees to this and they go down to the ship and they, reunite with the sisters and the captain and everybody's there. And it all seems very good, except these sisters have become extremely envious of their sister's ability to have found this man who's so amazing. And so they start plotting their demise and they ask her, "What are you going to do with this man?" And she says, "I'm going to marry him and you can keep all the wealth that we have made on the journey, all the wealth you pillaged out of this city." That was, all the people are stoned. And so they were taking all the wealth and stuff out of it. They said, "You can keep everything. All I want is him." And they say, "Oh yeah, that's a good deal." But then secretly in their hearts, they're still plotting against her and him. And so they go to bed and the sisters sneak in and they lift the mattress and they throw it into the ocean. And the man dies. He goes into the Book of Martyrs, it said. And she's able to swim, so she survives and she finds, some piece of driftwood and survives and gets to shore. As soon as she gets to shore, she starts walking. There's a single footpath that she can follow. And along comes this giant snake towards her, and it's racing towards her, and it's like slithering back and forth like it's trying to escape something. And behind the snake is a dragon, and the dragon is attacking the snake. And so she takes a rock and she throws it at the dragon's head and kills the dragon with one single throw. And the snake then grows wings and flies away. And this is shocking and crazy, and she's exhausted from seeing it. She's exhausted from her travails on the sea. She's exhausted from just everything, and so she just goes to sleep right there. And then when she wakes, this lady is there's a girl there massaging her feet, and there's these two female dogs. And she's startled by this, of course. And she says, "Who are you?" And she says, "Oh, you don't recognize me. I'm the genie that you rescued. I was in the form of the snake. And there was another genie attacking me. And you killed him.
And when I turned into this winged snake, I flew out to your ship. I got all of the riches off of it, and I transported them to your house. And then I wanted to kill your sisters, but that didn't seem right, so I turned them into these dogs, and here they are. By the inscription on the Ring of Solomon or something like that. I forget exactly what she says. Like, you have to beat these sisters with 300 lashes every single day. And if you don't, then I will turn you into a dog as well. And so she agrees to do that. And that's why she is beating her sisters or her these dogs every day with 300 lashes. And that's the end of her story.
Is that justice? Like, has justice been done at the end of the story, or like, does it end in just a different type of injustice than it began in?
Yeah, it's I mean, it seems like a different type of injustice, because there's no hope for any of, like, for, you know, they're trapped in this endless cycle now, where she has to beat these dogs every day, or she'll, you know, she'll get, there's never a sense in, like, oh, well, we'll come to a point where you've done enough, you know, your guilt has been, or she can't even forgive them again, you know, like, or even if she does forgive them, she has to continue beating them anyway. You know what I mean?
Right. They're in hell.
Yeah.
But it's like she is too, even though she hasn't really done anything wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. The genies have their own logic, I guess. That we don't get to understand. So yeah, it's a very weird ending to the story. Because I think
this story begins very similarly to, is it the second Sheik's story? There's another story much earlier in the book that has a very similar setup, where people are leaving. It's like three siblings, and
yes,
people are squandering their money and coming back.
Yeah, yeah, there is that. Which is kind of it's a kind of a classic fairy tale trope as well. You know, multiple siblings or brothers. You know, one wasting the money and one doing well with it, and so. This one felt a little fairy tale-ish as well, but definitely the ending was not what you'd expect from a fairy tale ending.
Right.
And to be clear, at the beginning, I didn't mention this. I probably should have, but because this is nested in another story, there was great curiosity about why this woman was beating these dogs every day. And then she would take them and like love them afterwards, you know, like hold them close to her. But she was still beating them. And so there does seem to be a sense in which she wishes she wasn't having to do this every day, but she knows that she can't stop, you know?
Yeah. That's what's interesting about it is, she gets to punish them, but she doesn't even really want to punish them anymore. You imagine that at first she might have taken some pleasure in it because they have wronged her.
Mm-hmm.
But it says explicitly that she feels pity for them, that she doesn't want to do it and she has to. So it's like divine justice has been done, and yet woe to the agent of that justice.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a strange story. Like, I don't know of another one that's quite like this. Any story I've ever heard.
Yeah, it is a weird one. I mean, there's definitely in this collection of tales that we read, there's definitely humans turning into animals as punishment for their wrongdoing. That's I would say pretty common in these first dozen stories or whatever we read, you know. Yeah, there was one of the stories, it was like Faithful Johannes or something like that, where the couple got thrown over the ship. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
In the Grimms. And so there was a little bit of parallel there. But yeah, you're right. The overall, the entire kingdom being turned to stone is a little bit like, Sleeping Beauty or something like that again.
Right.
Or even, Beauty and Beast, like the whole castle's enchanted. And we had some enchanted.
The two sisters being punished for their envy is kind of like Cinderella.
Yeah. So there, I mean, there are some, like, you can draw some parallels, but you're right that the overall structure, and especially just that unsatisfactory ending, it's like, yeah, it's very weird.
I actually find it much more fascinating than Cinderella. Like, this idea that they need to be punished basically eternally, and the only way to make that happen is to make the innocent party do it and threaten to punish her if she doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's like, she do? You know? I mean, all she's been this entire time is gracious and, like, you know? And, like, what's... I don't know. Yeah, I don't... It's very weird.
But you think about people who work in prisons or whatever, and that's got to be a hellish life for them too. It's got to be terrible to see people suffer, even if you feel like justice is being done in their suffering. Like, there's something deep in this story that I just don't know that I've ever seen it put in quite these terms before.
Yeah. But it's a story without grace, you know, like we talked about grace earlier on. And I mean, she does have grace for her sisters the first two times that they mess up, but then she's not allowed to have grace the third time. And that's where it's like, I don't know, there's something in the worldview or something. I don't want to make too much of it because, again, like we've said 10 times and we'll say 100 times more, I'm sure. But like, I don't know enough to speak well of, you know, the time or the place of these stories, but it does seem like in this particular story, it's like, no, you're not allowed to have grace in the way that you've been having it. It's, you know, like you said, justice has to be done. And in order for it to be done, it has to be done by you, which is a very, I don't know, it's a kind of a very foreign idea, I guess.
Well, the Grimms would have just killed the sisters.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they would have just died.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, like, they have to stay alive. They have to stay alive as these two dogs. And they have to be beaten every day by their sister who doesn't want to do it. Huh. Well, the Caliph is filled with wonder. That's Al-Rashid himself, the great Caliph after the Abbasid Revolution.
There you go.
He also doesn't know what to think of the story.
Yeah. And I don't remember, because I reread it, of course, but I didn't read on. I don't remember if there's anything to be said about it. So often these stories end and then that's the end, but you're right, because it's nested in another story. I don't remember if there is some other sort of conclusion out of it. But
I don't think so. I think it just goes on to the doorkeeper's story after that. And then that's the end of the Porter and the Three Ladies of Baghdad.
Right.
Which, boy, does that level one story just not at all end where it begins.
No. Yeah, not at all. Yeah. I think that's right. That's what I was thinking, is because in the third or the last story, the Porter story, there is a little bit of resolution, like, because they figure out that I can't remember all the details, but they're somehow related to the vizier that's there. And then, you know, there is some sort of resolution that happens, but not in this story. They just move on in the next story. So, well, that was fun.
Yep, and we'll be moving on next week. I think, or next month, I think we should go through night 34. That's going to take us through two more level one stories.
Okay. All right, so for those of you reading along at home, read nights 20 through 34. And
it's just two more main stories, Harun al-Rashid and the Fisherman's Chest and the Hunchback. And then, you know, 45 stories nested within. I'm sure we won't talk about the level one stories at all. But maybe we will. I don't know. We didn't this time.
Yeah, we didn't this time. They're hard to talk about because of all the nesting inside. And also, they're just not always as interesting as the nested stories, I think. So they're just there as a frame. So anyway, let's see. Do I have something to say here at the end? I got to find it. I got to scroll through my notes. Our press liaison is Kristen Filipik. We're on the old interwebs at christianhumanist.org. Help us continue this conversation by reaching out to us at beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. I do check that email. That does still exist. We want to encourage you to set your podcast player dials to the Christian Humanist Radio Network. There's a bunch of old stuff on there. Some of it's really good. Michael and I know there's a great number of podcasts out there you could spend your time on, so thank you for spending your time with us. And I didn't come up with a pithy ending. Oh, I actually do have one. Sorry. What is it? You don't have to edit this out. You can just have me ramble towards the end. Here we go. I say he is the sun, and the sun sets. I say he is the moon, and the moon's decline.